in an election where one side isn't happy with the outcome, their immediate response is to blame the process or blame the system. And so, you know, we're going to have a lot of work to do to dispel the myths and the misinformation and disinformation, because that's just spreading like wildfire.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. With all the confusion being thrown up about the recent election, I was happy to get a chance to talk to someone who really knows what goes on with voter administration. In this episode, Amber McReynolds, who runs a nonpartisan consultancy working to make voting work better for voters, returns to discuss what she and her team have been tackling with election officials around the country. I learned a lot, and it helped me feel more secure about our progress in this area. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Amber McReynolds and the National Vote From Home Institute.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Would you introduce yourself real quickly?
Sure. I'm Amber McReynolds. I'm the CEO of the National Vote at Home Institute and Coalition, and I'm also the former Director of Elections for the City and County of Denver, Colorado, and I served as an elections official for over 13 years.
Right. And we talked back, I think, around December of 2018 for an hour and kind of talked about your path to what you're doing right now. And I just wanted to catch up with you because it's been a hell of an election cycle and you've been right in the middle of it. What was the time like generally?
Our organization is about 3 years old. And as we talked last time, we've been really focused on trying to expand voting options for all voters across the country. And a lot of that certainly is voting at home and vote by mail options. We also advocate for advanced options like early voting and registration reforms and those sorts of things, really all with an effort to improve the voting experience for everyone and put voters first. That's kind of been our goal all along. And then the pandemic hit in 2020. And so March, my phone started ringing off the hook, frankly, with states and election officials and policymakers really looking for solutions for a year that would require modifications to the voting process to ensure that voters could vote safely in a pandemic. So we added quite a few team members to support that work. Our focus areas are really policy, as well as implementation support, as well as communications and voter research on the topic and all of that. So we've scaled quite significantly this year. We had more than 40 some people on our team this year working in various states and working with various states to help them scale their operations in a pandemic.
Were you able to scale by finding funding for nonprofit, or do you charge for these services? How do you grow like that?
We are a nonprofit. We're a national nonpartisan nonprofit, and our board is bipartisan, and our circle of advisors are bipartisan. All of our work that we've done has been, you know, funded by that nonpartisan nonprofit activity. So we did raise money to continue to do this work. We've been very blessed with the incredible support that we've received, and that's really enabled us to do what we set out to do this year.
I mean, we're talking just a few days after the election with some recounts going on and some counting still going on, or some recounts planned. And I just wonder, generally, how do you think we did as a country?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think the voters and also election officials in this country have demonstrated their resilience in amongst a very, very difficult election cycle. So I'm just incredibly grateful and incredibly impressed by the election official community that has responded to very difficult circumstances, the lack of funding, you know, outdated policies that they had to contend with, difficult resource issues with a pandemic, all of that. And then voters have demonstrated their resiliency. And the other story of this election is, you know, more than 100 million people cast their ballots prior to Election Day, with mostly using a mail ballot or voting early in person. And so I think the other lesson that everyone will pay close attention to after this election is that there's obviously a very big desire of voters to have options prior to one day of voting. And so I think that'll be a conversation that will last, you know, well into 2021 and even beyond. And then, you know, the other aspect of this is Election Day went relatively smoothly around the country. Great example is one of the states that I've referred to recently as being one of the most improved states. You look at a Georgia, their average wait times across the state was around 4 minutes on Election Day. And in the primary, where they, you know, didn't have all the things in place that they had for the general, they had, you know, 4-hour lines on Election Day in various places. So Georgia is an example of a state that made a lot of modifications very quickly, improved greatly, and they also stand out as being one of those states that had a relatively smooth Election Day. And we saw that around the country, frankly. And I think the reason that Election Day was smooth is because the vast majority of people voted prior to Election Day.
What sort of changes did election officials, administrators make over the course of this last 2 years that helped it go better?
So a couple of things, at least on the vote by mail front. Many states stood up an online absentee ballot request process. So Kentucky and Georgia both did that. Many other states did as well, including Michigan and Wisconsin, and a couple of other states added online functionality to their process. States also adopted ballot tracking. So we worked with Nevada, as well as Georgia and California and a few other states to implement ballot tracking. And that is a significant improvement over 2018 or even 2016. And then a lot of jurisdictions at the county level also purchased higher speed equipment that could scan ballots more effectively, vote by mail ballots more effectively and more quickly. Milwaukee is a great example. We work directly with them to implement some new equipment in between their primary in April and then the general election. And that really enabled them to process those ballots faster than they would have or had done before. So those are some of the administrative and implementation changes. And then there was also a very big effort on educating the public about the voting options in front of them, how to utilize the vote by mail process. And so we've seen a lot of really good success stories out of that effort because voters, you know, had more information directly from election officials about the process. And then policymakers, you know, there were some states did make adjustments at the policy level to make things easier on election officials as well as voters. Vermont, New Jersey, Nevada, Washington, D.C., and Montana actually as well. They all expanded vote by mail and they mailed a ballot to everyone. Montana was over 97% that got a ballot automatically. All those states expanded this greatly and they, for the first time, mailed a ballot to everyone in their state and they therefore had very little issues on Election Day because most people had utilized that process in advance. And then other policymakers failed. So a good example, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, all of those state legislative bodies had proposals in front of them that was supported by bipartisan election clerks and the election officials, as well as organizations like mine. We were all saying election officials need time, more time in advance of Election Day to process mail ballots. And yet Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, Michigan made a slight adjustment, but all of them did not give election officials adequate time. And so it took a long time for counties to work through that process because they couldn't start working on it till Election Day. And then Congress failed to provide adequate funding. So they only provided $400 million to states in the CARES Act, which really wasn't enough. I mean, it helped a little bit, but it really wasn't enough. And so election officials had to grapple with very little resources in the middle of a pandemic that was modifying a lot of their procedures.
It's unavoidable to talk about the claims of fraud. Is there any possibility that there are, is significant fraud in any state?
No, and there's not significant widespread fraud. What I would say, though, is that every election cycle, there is a post-election process. You review everything. Certainly, there will likely be, you know, specific issues in specific states, depending on what that is. There was a story out of Florida where a guy wanted to test the system, and he's getting charged with fraud now because he tried to submit two ballots and they caught him. But he claimed he did it because he wanted to test the system and he was caught. We're going to see instances like that where people tried to do things to either test the system or because they just didn't understand how the process worked. But that's all part of that post-election process. And the reason that we see so little fraud, and when I say so little, I mean, it's extremely rare. Like over the last 20 years, I think 0.0006% of all mail ballots have had an issue. And the reason for that is because there are systems in place to prevent it, detect it, and then hold those accountable that do try to do something they should be doing. So that's really why there isn't massive fraud, because there's system and security checks in place to prevent it.
Could you explain what you mean by those systems and security checks?
With regards to vote by mail specifically, first and foremost, in most states, you have to request a ballot. So you have to fill out a form and you have to submit that. And there's validation of that. So they're checking to see that you're a registered voter, that your address is up to date. And then in some states, they even compare the signature on the application to the record. And that's all happens before the ballot is mailed. Then the ballot is mailed to the voter's registration address or mailing address, depending on what they designate. And the voter then gets that, then they turn that back in. And then in most states, that signature is then checked against the system. So there's sort of multiple checks in that process. The states that mail ballots to all active voters, it's only active voters, they use that address of record. Most of them also do national change of address checks where they're checking to see if the address is still current before they're sending the ballot out. But the first step in that process is, you know, the registration information, got to be an active voter. They can't be inactive and get a ballot mailed to you. And so that address check and then the check of sending the ballot itself to the voter, the ballots can't be forwarded. So if the voter moves after ballots go out, that ballot will go back to election officials and it will be marked as inactive or undeliverable. And then if the voter does get their ballot at home and then they fill it out, turn it back in, again, the signature process checks to be sure that the voter is the voter. Some states have alternate processes beyond signatures. If the signature doesn't match in a state that checks that, there's a cure process in most states where the voter is notified. They have to provide an affidavit and a copy of their ID to resolve that discrepancy. So all those different checks happen in the vote by mail process. And then kind of on top of all of that, there was also widespread use or more widespread use of ballot tracking systems this year. And that adds another security feature because it allows a voter to track their ballot through the entire process, just like you would track a package. And then you get confirmation that your ballot was received and headed into the counting room by the election officials.
My wife and I voted in DC and then we checked the tracking and we voted early and hers, you know, when she tracked it, like nearly the next day, it went through. Mine took a couple days and went through, but we were able to see that. And that was kind of helpful, I think. You mentioned policy failure in some of those key states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Why was it that bipartisan reforms to make things go quicker in the counting couldn't go through?
Well, we were working on all three of those states for about a year, actually. I mean, election officials have been talking about this since 2019 in all of these states. And we were making really good progress, honestly. We were having great discussions with Republican as well as Democratic legislators. And unfortunately, earlier this year, a lot of tweeting started about the vote by mail process. And so that really halted a lot of the good progress we had made. And you know, deals just did not get made in those legislative bodies. And it's really unfortunate because it is nonpartisan, it is technical, and it put election officials in a very difficult position. And then now after the election or last week, people were complaining that Pennsylvania wasn't done and that Wisconsin and Michigan weren't done yet. And that simple change would have prevented them from taking a longer period of time. And frankly, they did an excellent job within the constraints they had. I mean, the fact that Pennsylvania was able to finish by Friday, given the quantity they had, and Michigan finished earlier and Wisconsin finished even earlier, given the quantities they had to process, it's pretty incredible that election officials were able to get that done in that amount of time, given the constraints they had.
You mentioned tweeting started, and we know who was tweeting. Do you understand at all the motivation? I mean, he started so early in trying to undermine vote by mail when it's not at all clear, I don't think, that it was going to help one party over the other. Do you understand the motivation behind all that?
There was some narrative from a similar candidate, same candidate in 2016. But what I would say is what's interesting is that vote by mail has not been partisan up until this year. I mean, Florida has expanded it. They were one of the first states to expand it greatly. Part of the reason for that is they have a population that, you know, really likes to vote by mail, and that a lot of Republicans in Florida have traditionally voted by mail, and they've often turned their ballot in earlier. Those numbers really dropped off once it got to be a partisan issue this year. And states like Utah and Nebraska and North Dakota and Montana, all of these states have expanded this form of voting greatly because they know it serves their voters. You know, I feel like that it kind of got politicized in Washington, D.C., but really the rest of the country, that hasn't necessarily been the case. I think this election and the outcome and the fact that one side is blaming vote by mail is certainly making that conversation and that narrative more difficult now. But up to 2020, it was not a partisan issue. It's a benefit to voters, all voters, to have options to vote. You know, who knows what the pundits will say after this election, but I really think the president hurt himself by disparaging a form of voting that many, many, many Republicans, his supporters, have used for a long period of time. And so that's the unfortunate part about it, is that ultimately voters lost out. Doubt was cast on a method of voting they've used. They didn't maybe utilize it. They had to go wait in line on election day or whatever it might be. And so ultimately voters are the ones that lose out when elections, you know, get attacked from a partisan perspective.
Did that cause a problem for you, since you are a nonpartisan entity, to navigate the partisanship that suddenly was thrown on the key thing that you're promoting and working to implement?
Yes and no. I mean, we've been very specific from the beginning and very clear that we have advocated for systems that provide benefit to voters and also improve the election administration process and enhance security. That's been our goal all along. And so, and we, again, we have a bipartisan circle of advisors. We have a bipartisan board. So we have, you know, support on all sides of the aisle attached to our organization. And that's been very important to me. I think I shared with you last time, I'm unaffiliated. I've always been unaffiliated. And I think that this election administration operates so much better when the partisan politics are out of it and are not kind of used as a battle within it. So that's the part that, you know, certainly it got more complicated. Certainly I got a lot of very interesting and nasty, you know, messages into my social media accounts and things like that once I started talking about this more on the news, which is unfortunate because I've never made any comments about a candidate and I've never supported a candidate on either side of the aisle for this election. But it hurt, you know, a little bit, and it certainly impacted those of us that have been working very hard to make the voting process more accessible and more convenient for all to, you know, be attacked in that way. And I think same with election officials. You know, they've been trying to do their jobs, and yet they've been attacked and received death threats and all of this. It's very sad.
I think there's a lot of people really misinformed. Do you think it's going to cause problems going forward? I assume that you're going to continue in your efforts to move the country forward in administration. Is that going to cause problems as we approach the next two-year election?
I don't know yet. We're going to continue to work on both sides of the aisle. I mean, we worked in states like Georgia and Kentucky and, you know, Nevada, really all over the country. We worked in over 30 states this year with election officials of all partisan leanings as well as policymakers. And so, you know, we're going to continue to do the research, share the right information, share the good information, share the factual information about this process. But I also, at the same time, also believe that continuous improvement in our election systems is absolutely critical. And, you know, we also want to pay very close attention to the lessons learned from 2020 and how we make our systems more resilient, more accessible, more convenient, and more secure for all. And, you know, there's always ways to do that. And so we'll continue to work on that. We're always happy to help with legislation and legislators on both sides of the aisle and in improving this process. And I do think election officials are very much the key to improving election administration. Because as I always say, the more successful election officials are, the more successful voters are. So we really also need to pay very close attention to what election officials, you know, what their lessons learned are, what they recommend out of this process, because they're really, they're the ones that serve voters directly in each election.
I mean, it's early, but what lessons do you think are going to come from them and from you from 2020?
Well, I think first and foremost, these few states that did not allow the processing of mail ballots in advance of Election Day, that's a mistake. And I've already seen even this week a Republican senator actually propose legislation at the federal level to deal with that. So clearly people have recognized that that is not going to work. I think the second big thing is that the states that restricted absentee voting based on age or required an excuse or made it difficult had issues. So Oklahoma had 5-hour lines on Election Day. They were one of the states that did not have very accessible absentee voting or early voting. And they had a lot of, you know, they had a lot of volume issues on Election Day. So I think there's going to be a lot of lessons learned that when you offer people more options in advance of Election Day, including vote by mail, including early voting, your election day is a lot smoother. And voters clearly want it because more than 100 million and, you know, all said and done, we estimate that vote by mail is going to approach 50% of the all votes cast. We'll see how that breaks down. But, you know, at the numbers right now, look to be that it's going to come close to that. And so if half the country of all party stripes chose to vote by mail this year, that's something that policymakers need to consider in terms of expanding those options. And so, you know, we want to get rid of these states that require excuses. We want to work with those legislative bodies to get rid of that. Texas is a great example. Tennessee, Mississippi, Arkansas, Missouri, all of those states still require an excuse. And that just doesn't make sense, especially in a pandemic. I think the other aspect of this is that the country is clearly very divided. And what often happens, and we see this all the time in an election where one side isn't happy with the outcome, their immediate response is to blame the process or blame the system. And so, you know, we're going to have a lot of work to do to dispel the myths and the misinformation and disinformation, because that's just spreading like wildfire. But also to have a conversation of, all right, you know, trust in the process is really important. How do we restore trust in the process? How do we make this more transparent? You know, how do we enhance security? How do we deal with myths and disinformation, which was honestly one of the biggest challenges in this election cycle, just like it was in 2016. So I think all of those questions and conversations are going to be really important after this cycle. And then the final thing I would say is, look, election offices around the country, there's more than 9,000 local election offices that run this process. They're heavily underfunded. The federal government does not fund elections the way that they should be funded. So I think we have to have a funding conversation. And along with that, we need to talk about election governance. The United States is very unique in terms of modern democracies in that we have a lot of partisan politics involved in our election process. Secretaries of state are obviously elected in a partisan way. The legislature, legislative bodies make the decisions as to the rules of the game. And, you know, we, I think, need to look at this and talk about how we kind of isolate or at least make elections more independent from partisan fighting, because it should be about who votes, not who wins.
Is there a proposal on that kind of independence front that has any chance, do you think?
Well, you know, we have a federalized system, so every state is responsible for their own, the conduct of elections. The federal level, you know, there's the Federal Election Commission, which really is only focused on campaign finance issues. And then the Election Assistance Commission, which was created out of, after Florida 2000, out of the Help America Vote Act. And, you know, both entities have, you know, really don't have a lot of power. They've essentially been sidelined in a lot of ways just because of the partisan nature of both entities. So I think we need to really consider, what is the federal role for supporting elections? What does that look like? How can we have a better conversation about funding? And then how does that relate to the state management of elections, which is, you know, sort of how that breaks down. Other countries like Canada, you know, they have chief electoral officers in their provinces that are independent. They are not allowed to support candidates. They're not allowed to contribute to political campaigns. They have very high ethical standards, and they're appointed and approved by the governing bodies. And they're the ones, they're basically technical people that oversee the process. So I think we just need to consider all options like that to make sure that, you know, we continue to improve the process. And we also build trust amongst the American electorate. I really do feel like so many of the accusations that were directed at secretaries of state or local election officials were partisan based. They weren't based on fact. They've been based on the partisan leaning of the person that they were targeting. So given that, I think we just need to talk about, what is independence and what does the governance process look like? And there's a lot of ideas on that. I don't think there's a specific proposal on that I've seen, but there are a lot of ideas, and there's certainly a lot of us that have talked about this at length for a long period of time.
There's a campaign of misinformation and disinformation that's actually coming from the President of the United States, though. How can a system that is technical withstand that kind of accusation?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's exactly, you know, one of the things that certainly came out of this election cycle that we didn't have in 2016. And that's, you know, after the 2016 election cycle, President Obama finally deemed election infrastructure to be critical. Or prior to 2016, it was not considered to be critical infrastructure. It very much is critical infrastructure. You know, obviously we want to make sure and prevent foreign actors from getting involved in elections, but we also need to treat it as such. It's critical infrastructure. And one thing that, you know, was fantastic actually this year is CISA, which is an entity of Homeland Security. They have a whole rumor control webpage where they've been dispelling and responding to all of this misinformation online. And that was not available. That was not there in 2016. They've been doing a great job, I think, of real-time responses and tracking this info. And certainly those sorts of efforts are going to have to be enhanced. And then I think that, you know, the social media aspect of things is a very important part of the conversation. What does that look like online? How is that managed? What does that look like going forward, given how much of this was really about the internet? So much of the misinformation and disinformation is flooding the airways on social media, and that thinking about the governance of those platforms as it relates to this is really, really important too.
We talked a little bit about this, but the states that mail out ballots without having them requested, to my inclination, that's a good idea. It's likely to turn into more people voting. That was kind of specifically attacked as more vulnerable to fraud and more disruptive of normal turnout, I guess. Is there a problem with that? It seems like a good idea.
So it absolutely is a good idea. I mean, I think that you heard a lot of the, oh, these are unsolicited ballots. Well, my response to that, first off, there's no such thing as an unsolicited ballot, because we're only mailing ballots to active registered voters. And if you actually take the step of registering to vote, clearly you're expressing your intent to get a ballot. So there's no other reason to register to vote other than the fact that you want to vote. So I think, you know, the states that were mailing ballots to everyone, there were five going into 2020, and that obviously Colorado, Oregon, Washington, and then Hawaii passed it last year. Utah also became an all vote by mail state last year. California was already on their way, but an additional five jurisdictions, four states plus Washington, D.C., mailed a ballot to everyone this year. And in looking at that data, at least right now, all of them are, you know, have outpaced other states on turnout. Vermont, New Jersey, California, Washington, D.C., you know, they were not swing states. They were not swing jurisdictions, but their turnout is very, very high comparative to what they've had before. And so I think a lot of these data points coming out of this election are going to be important. Obviously, that's a state legislative decision, unless there ends up being federal agreement on that for a federal election. But, you know, I think we're going to see more states. In Montana, 97% of people voted with a ballot that was mailed to them at home. So I think certainly states are going to look at this very closely, look at what makes sense going forward. And, you know, some states are going to expand and act on that. Other states are going to make incremental changes. Other states will make things permanent that they, you know, modified this year. I'm certainly partial to this type of model. It's what we had in Colorado. And I would specify or clarify that there's no such thing as universal vote by mail or all vote by mail. Yes, those states mailed a ballot to everyone in advance, but you still have a right to vote in person if you want to. You still have options to vote in person. And that can look very different in every state. Colorado has a very big in-person voting offering. They offer vote centers. You can go to any of them. So there's sort of, in addition to mailing a ballot, there's also the conversation of how do we modernize the in-person voting process to make it more accessible to everyone and more available to everyone, which is important.
I mean, it seems telling to be complaining about people getting quote unquote unsolicited ballots in states that weren't even really contested in the presidential.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty odd for sure. And I really commend the states like Vermont, New Jersey, you know, they made these adjustments in a very short window of time this year. And California is the largest state population wise. And they had, you know, very little issues on election day, primarily because most people voted prior to election day or used a mail ballot. And, you know, the fact that the largest state in the country population wise made it happen relatively quickly is pretty telling. And it's certainly a testament to the Secretary of State there, as well as the county officials, which I think are some of the best in the country. They're awesome. They all worked very, very hard and very early this year to make that happen. And similarly, you know, Nevada, Vermont, New Jersey, they reached out to organizations like ours to say, how do we do this well? We want to adopt best practices. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. We need to, you know, adopt what works. And so like Nevada, you know, they implemented ballot tracking. They had statewide ballot tracking so voters could get email and text. And they got that up and running within a few months. So did Georgia. So, you know, I think that all of those states that made that decision, they also can be heralded as a good example of what can be done, but also as states that acted quickly and made a lot of adjustments very, very fast, actually, in the middle of a pandemic.
Why, when they do a recount, does the total change? It typically changes very slightly, a tiny percentage, but why is it different? Or why can't it be different?
So the main reason, usually you don't see any variance with votes that are cast, for instance, on a ballot marking device or on a machine, mainly because there's no voter intent issues, right? Like you can't undervote on a machine. You can't overvote on a machine. You can undervote it, but you get a problem.
They make you vote in all of the circles, and overvote, you can't indicate two circles when you're
right.
Not supposed to.
And you also can't on a machine. You have to choose the, you know, the X or the circle, right? You can't like circle the name, but on a hand marked ballot, like a paper ballot, a vote by mail ballot, voter intent matters. And the reason is that, you know, some people will not fill in the oval all the way, but they'll fill it in just enough to indicate that they intended to do something, or they might have circled the names instead of filling in the oval, or maybe they put a check mark that wasn't caught by the equipment. So it just can vary because people are making the marks, right? And people vary in terms of the pens they use, the marks they make, all of that. So the usual variance we see relates to voter intent. And states vary in terms of the technology they have available on the front end to review that voter intent. So Colorado, as an example, has digital adjudication. So any ballot that's undervoted or, you know, we have a threshold of the oval being completed that we look at, we basically in Colorado want to see every ballot that might be questionable in terms of the markings when we're going through the normal process. And the reason is we want to get to almost that recount threshold where we're essentially reviewing any ballot that might have voter intent. That digital adjudication enables that to happen. So Colorado has a technology in place to do that. Georgia has the same system with digital adjudication. They've not had as many mail ballots hand marked on paper as they do this year. Some of that variance may come up because, again, it's people marking the pieces of paper, and then it's also people hand tallying and, you know, working through that process. So that's really where we see the variance, if any. I've never seen that overthrow the result, and I don't think it'll happen this time, but that variance really comes from hand marked paper ballots more than anything.
The notion of the signature matching that you mentioned, like that someone would check to make sure that my signature matched my ballot and something on file, and my signature is not always reliably similar. How can that be really realistically done?
Well, so, you know, again, it varies by state. Not every state does validation with signatures, but the way that the signature matching happens in, you know, especially the states that have done a lot of this, is that they, you know, bring up the most recent signature they have on file. They also have, like Colorado may have 20, 30 signatures for each voter. Like they maintain those signatures.
Wow.
And then the other aspect is what Colorado has done is also put standards in place for how a signature is reviewed and what's considered if it were to be rejected. And there's also a tiered process. So in some cases, a lot of the larger jurisdictions utilize software because they're just looking at a one-to-one match. And for the most part, software can get a pretty high percentage. You know, it's just looking at a match, one-to-one match. And then if the software can't do it, it goes to a team, bipartisan team. They will look at it and make a determination. Any that are flagged as discrepant go to a research team. And that includes two people of different party affiliations. They pull up all the different signatures that a voter may have on file, and then they make a determination. They have to decide collectively. If they can't decide, they'll invite another bipartisan team to see if they have a different opinion, or they'll invite the supervisor into the conversation. If the signature is deemed as a mismatch, there's a cure process. So then the voter's notified, and there's lots of ways to cure, but you can do it via email, via text in some states now. By sending in an affidavit, but you're basically, as a voter, asked for more information to validate that vote. The best way, too, is to train election judges on what to look for. So, for instance, the training that Colorado utilizes was developed first in Denver, utilizing a handwriting expert that trained law enforcement. There are elements of the signature that you can look for. All the counties in Colorado go through that same training, and there's this consistency. So that's sort of how that process works.
I wish that everybody sort of had access to that information broadly about the voting process. There would be a lot fewer of these conspiracy theories that would get anywhere. I'm curious, Amber, what's your life like these days?
Oh, there's still not been downtime. So we're still on the phone with a lot of the states we worked with. We're already getting calls about policy changes for 2021. I'm talking to the media a lot, really explaining the process. Because I think, you know, one of the other, I think, good things that came out of 2020 is that there's been more attention finally paid to the conduct of the election, the administration of the election. And so the media actually, I think, has done a very good job of covering this, covering these topics, explaining this process more so than we've ever seen. And I think that's a huge benefit to the American electorate generally, that there be more transparency, more information, and more out there in the public domain about this process. Because kind of it's one of those things where I feel like everyone talks about the campaign stuff and the candidates, but nobody talks about the actual technical process of your vote being cast and how it's counted and what the process is for recount, all those things. So my life is, you know, we're very busy. The team, I have an awesome team, which I'm really proud of. And we've accomplished a lot this year. I'm also a single mom. And interestingly enough, on election day, my children have been in school since August 19th, in-person school. And on election day, I got a call from their school saying that a teacher in one of the other classrooms came down with COVID. And so they were shutting down the school for 2 weeks. So I had to like get my kids home and quarantined on election day while I was like trying to run our, or trying to be in our war room and all that. So we're doing homeschooling. So the shuffling of papers that you heard, they both kind of sit here with me during the day and work on their math and activities. So that was some of that shuffling you heard early on.
I was wondering about that. just one, maybe one last question about Georgia. So they announced they're going to recount all of the votes by hand. Is that likely to be more or less accurate than counting with machines and counting by hand those that need to be?
It looks like they're going to do just one race. So likely the way that they will handle this is they'll do what's called the stack method. And basically what that means is they will sort the ballots. So Trump votes in, you know, a pile, Biden votes in another pile, and others.
Will they use the highest pile method, or they pile all of the ballots in the entire state into one stack and then measure them?
No, but basically what they'll do by county is they'll separate votes for Biden, for Trump, and then for other, you know, into different piles. And then they will essentially use the scanning equipment they have to get counts. They won't use the tabulation software per se, so they won't ask the equipment to reread what it already read, but they will essentially get a count using that equipment because the equipment can give them a count. So that's likely how they will do it because they're only doing one race.
So when it's like hand sorting, but then machine riffling and counting. Is that right?
So yeah, they'll basically use the scanners to get counts, essentially how they'll do that. Because it's only one race. If they were doing multiple races, they'd have to do more of a hand tally sheet. And then that process also might vary for mail ballots, because as I mentioned, mail ballots are hand marked. So voter intent, those ballots might get segregated to be considered by bipartisan teams.
Is there a question that I didn't ask you that you'd like to answer?
All I would say finally is, you know, our work is going to continue to create systems that put voters first. I mean, we set out to do that 3 years ago. We're going to continue to do that work. And when I say that, I mean all voters, regardless of your political persuasion, regardless of who you voted for, you should have access to a voting system that you can rely on, that you can trust, that you can be a part of, that you can be proud of, all of that. And, you know, one of the other things I always say about the election certification process and sort of the results of the election, it's just as important to declare a winner as it is to convince the loser that they lost, right? So that confidence in the process is very, very important. And we will, at Vote at Home, we're going to continue to work with states to improve the vote by mail systems that are currently on the books, expand options for voters, and then also improve the security and accessibility and transparency of our voting system.
Do you get involved in the questions of, like, there's a lot of accusations about where polling locations have been closed or how many drop-off locations there were in Texas? This idea of one per county didn't seem to make much sense. Is that something that's part of the scope of what you do?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, we definitely work directly with election officials. We've done a lot of that this year, especially, and we will continue to work with, you know, states and locals and state officials on processes. Processes is a big piece of our implementation work. So like I mentioned, we've done a lot with Georgia this year. We're going to continue to do that. So yeah, we're definitely a resource to election officials and also policymakers, and we'll certainly continue that work.
Well, thanks for doing the work that you did this year and for going forward with it. Appreciate your time today. Anything else you want to say?
No, I think that's it. Thank you so much.
That was Amber McReynolds. Amber is at voteathome.org. You might also check out her earlier interview on this podcast. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at greatbattlefield.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.